Hello and welcome to Martian Driving Podcast number 88. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around the subject is space westerns, or at least science fiction westerns. We're going to look at two of them, fairly recent, but different in a lot of ways, and it'll be good to compare and contrast them. The first one is 2010's
The Martian Driving Podcast appears every 2 weeks.
Daniel Craig and Harrison Ford.
Science fiction,
and
horror,
then we go back
and
a little while longer
appreciation,
to a fan favorite.
And sometimes television.
Serenity,
doesn't matter if it's old or new, good or bad, black Nathan or Villian, white Marina or colour. As long as I like it,
host of
it
others.
May show up.
So
there are also occasional roundtables where I get together
way,
a group of like-minded people and discuss a particular topic of interest to genre film nerds. You can support the podcast by donating at patreon.com/paleocinema. You can keep up with podcast news at the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can leave reviews on iTunes and send MP3 or written feedback to cultguru@gmail.com. That's cult with a K. This podcast may contain adult discussions, so don't listen to it in the car while driving the kids to school.
Hey people, it's going to be an interesting week because at the end of this week, for 4 days, I'm going to be at Continuum 12, which is the local science fiction convention. I'm going to be recording Martian Drive-In live with Narelle Harris and Grant Watson. So, and probably I'll rope in a couple of other people as well, maybe. We're going to make a little bit of a jamboree of it, and it'll be a lot of fun. But, nothing much happening here. It's winter. It's been wet and windy and unnecessarily cold and foggy and all those other things we associate with shit weather. We're halfway through an election campaign here, which is a lot shorter than election campaigns seem to be in the United States of America. We don't have anybody quite as demented as Donald Trump for whom to vote against. But it still has its moments of interest, though. For us, a 9-week election campaign is quite long, and the politicians are all out running around the country telling people lies in order to get our vote. And it's a bit of a marathon. It's just totally crazy. Everything's on hold waiting for that. It's still a toss-up as to whether the forces of darkness or the forces of light win. The forces of light aren't quite as light as they used to be, of course. But we'll see. And, of course, here's something to suggest for America. We have a great tradition with elections here in Australia called the sausage sizzle. Elections, you go down to vote at a local school and they set up the basketball court or the gymnasium in the school for you to go and do your voting. And the school makes a little bit of money on it by selling sausages in bread or sometimes bacon and egg rolls for breakfast. So you rock down there fairly early, you do your democratic stuff, and then you go and have a sausage with tomato sauce on bread or a bacon and egg roll. It's a great tradition. In fact, there's a couple of websites around that will tell you which of your local schools is actually doing a sausage sizzle on election day, which is one of the early Saturdays in July, by the way. So, I think that all countries should have that. I don't think you should have an election without a sausage sizzle. For us, it's part of the democratic process. We have compulsory voting here, which means that people actually see it as an obligation and a legal obligation and a kind of democratic obligation to go and vote. It's not one of those things that you can decide not to do and then bitch and moan for the next 3 years about. I kind of like that system. I think that getting people involved is quite important, and it's a kind of safeguard of democracy to ensure that people do vote. And even if they just draw a dick on the paper, which is something some people do, they're at least getting out of their house and getting a bit of exercise. So I'll let you know how that goes. I'm not optimistic or pessimistic. I'm just kind of holding my emotions at bay about that one. But, we'll just have to wait and see what happens and how the next 3 years for Australia go. I hope it's a much more compassionate future that we have. But that's still very much up in the air. That then moves us on to the next bit, which is what I've been watching. I just took a look at my Letterboxd, and there isn't a hell of a lot. There is one thing I want to do for a future Martian Drive-In podcast, and I'll kind of foreshadow it so people can watch the movie. It's a movie from about a year ago called Listening. It's a small-budget science fiction movie, which is on Netflix, so you can access it fairly easily. And it's about the invention of computerized telepathy. It's done on a small scale, but it's quite frightening and done quite well. And the interesting thing is the technology and all the techno geek stuff is there, but it's mostly about the people involved and their emotions and their lives and things. So they've kind of done an interesting thing there. It's, as I said, it's not the best movie in the world and it's not the biggest movie in the world, but I think it's interesting enough that I've put it on the list for a future Martian Drive-In, because I really think that encouraging small budget science fiction movies like this one and like Advantageous that I spoke about on a previous Martian Drive-In podcast, Jennifer Pong's really interesting science fiction movie from a couple of years ago. I think that that's one of the things I want to do with the podcast. Yes, I'm going to be doing the big blockbuster ones, kind of like I'm doing this week. But I also want to kind of hip people to the smaller, interesting stuff that's coming out. Even though it's not utterly perfect, I think that putting eyes on small budget, quirky and interesting science fiction films encourages the makers and hopefully helps them out. Because Netflix does keep those statistics, and if I can encourage a few people to watch one of these films, I feel that I'm helping the people who made them. But listening is definitely worth checking out. The only other thing I've done of interest, and I've been kind of binging Netflixy a bit, is there's a French Netflix made miniseries of 8 episodes called Marseille, which stars Gérard Depardieu as a guy who's been the mayor of Marseille for 20 years. And he's decided not to run for election, but circumstances change and he decides to run again against his deputy mayor, a younger man, with whom he has an unknown family history. It's quite interesting as well. The dubbing is okay. I would have preferred it was subtitled, but they've decided to dub it with some fairly good voice actors, but it has some beautiful scenery in there, some good action scenes, some violence and some sex and nudity, which always piques my interest a bit. But, it's worth checking out. I don't think it's the best thing in the world. I don't think it's another Game of Cards or anything like that. But just seeing a French political drama is a little bit different. And so I binge-watched all 8 episodes yesterday. And one of the things I loved about it, which is a entirely subjective and personal thing, is at the end of the episode, they play old French pop songs from the 50s, 40s, 50s, 60s to underline the theme of the particular episode. They did a couple of ones I really like. They did Serge Gainsbourg's Requiem pour le Con, which means Requiem for a Cunt. And they also did one of my favourite Charles Trenet songs. They did Douce France, and they also did Caresse de Tille de Nous Amours, which is my favourite Charles Trenet song. So, I kind of grooved on that. It's those little kind of tweaks and little bits of stuff that keep you interested in things sometimes. But Marseille is worth checking out. So anyway, I'm going to take a break, and when I get back, I'm going to talk in reverse chronological order about these films and do the one that I think doesn't quite work, but is still fairly interesting, and that is Jon Favreau's 2010 movie Cowboys and Aliens, starring Harrison Ford and Daniel Craig. We'll be right back. That, of course, was Barry Gray's theme to Space 1999, which is kind of cool. I like that, the fact that it's got a little bit of disco waka chika in there, and it's very bombastic. I actually rewatched a few episodes of Space 1999 not too long ago, and apart from the stupid costumes and the groovy 1970s set designs and those wonderful Eagle transporter spaceships, it was pretty lame. I think what it needed was some decent script writers, and unfortunately it didn't have them. So let's get on with Cowboys and Aliens, which is a 2011, I may have said 2010 before, but it's a 2011 science fiction movie starring Daniel Craig, Harrison Ford, Olivia Wilde, Paul Dano, and Sam Rockwell, and Adam Beach, amongst others. We've also got Keith Carradine and Clancy Brown, which were both really good choices. Here is the synopsis from IMDb, which was written by Universal Studios themselves. The Old West, where a lone cowboy leads an uprising against a terror from beyond our world. 1873, New Mexico Territory. A stranger with no memory of his past stumbles into the hard desert town of Absolution. The only hint to his history is a mysterious shackle that encircles one wrist. What he discovers is that the people of Absolution don't welcome strangers, and nobody makes a move on the streets unless ordered to do so by the iron-fisted Colonel Dolahide, Harrison Ford. It's a town that lives in fear, but Absolution is about to experience fear it can scarcely comprehend as the desolate city is attacked by marauders from the sky, screaming down with breathtaking velocity and blinding lights to abduct the helpless one by one. These monsters challenge everything the residents have ever known. Now, the stranger they rejected is their only hope of salvation. As the gunslinger slowly starts to remember who he is and where he's been, he realizes he holds a secret that could give the town a chance. So that's basically it. That's hyperbole and badly written, but that's the synopsis that I've got. So I'll play the trailer and then talk about the things I enjoyed in the film and the places where I think it just doesn't work.
It's not your lucky day, stranger. Turn around and start walking. I said, turn around and start walking. Do I know you?
You don't remember anything.
Jake Lonergan, turning you over to the federal marshal.
Boss, Lonergan's in town.
I want that man. You give him to me now, or I'm gonna take him.
Okay, this movie was directed by Jon Favreau, who just had a lot of success with Iron Man 1 and 2 and kind of left Marvel for a while and went off on his own projects. I much more prefer his personal project, Chef, which if you haven't seen, I definitely recommend. But this one was a big studio picture. It had been in development hell for at least a decade before it got made, which is always something that you've kind of got to be wary of to a certain extent. And if you have a look at the writers involved in it, there are a busload of writers involved. And that's another thing too, where it gives you an indication that it's been churned over a number of times by a number of different writers, different people trying to make it work. It's very, very rarely a recipe for a good, cogent, through-line, perfect film. Now, there are things that are good about it. First off, Daniel Craig's pretty damn good as Jake Lonergan, the amnesiac gunslinger. He makes it kind of work for him. He's got a slight Steve McQueen feel about him in doing this, and I like him a lot. I think that Sam Rockwell's a little bit wasted in the film. I don't think his role is core to what's happening there. I like Clancy Brown playing the town preacher, who's kind of one of those preachers who doesn't ram the Bible down your throat, but rams the principles of the Bible down your throat. And it's really beautiful to watch him here. There's also Keith Carradine playing the sheriff, whose grandson is living with him while his father makes a go of it somewhere else. And Keith Carradine's very good in this as well. The characters of both the preacher and the sheriff feel very lived in. They're very kind of together. They work well in the context of a Western. And I found myself really wanting to see more of those guys, because they're the kind of guys I know from Westerns. They're not necessarily a stereotype, but they're a stock character fleshed out by the skill of the actors more than the skill of the script. And I really like that and appreciate that part. Olivia Wilde playing the mysterious female stranger, not so much. I think that one of the problems is that she looks like a person from the 21st century. And that kind of doesn't work. They really kind of needed to cast somebody who could play someone of the period, even though she's not necessarily of the period in an intrinsic sense. And I'm not going to do spoilers beyond saying that. But so it's like she's in a different movie than everybody else, and that's never a good thing with the female lead. I'm not going to say love interest, because it doesn't end up playing out that way. But the female lead, it really kind of doesn't work. There are any number of skilled actors who could play the role and play it in the context of the time, but I don't think that Olivia Wilde does that, and that's a bit unfortunate. And also, I don't know that she has the presence that the character needs. There are any number of women who have done fantastically well in Westerns, and up to this stage, it's definitely still a Western. Now, this was produced by Steven Spielberg, and Spielberg gave Favreau a bunch of classic Westerns, mostly John Wayne, John Ford kind of Westerns, but I think that that may not have been what he should have really gone for. And I'm a big fan, as you know, of Bud Bedeker's Westerns, and I think that taking a Bedeker approach to the cowboys and aliens might have worked a little bit better, because the characters are broadly sketched but well lived, and I think that there are a few characters in this movie that really needed that. They needed to be better fleshed out. They needed to be played by a certain type of person. And Bedeker, I think, is a better fit for this kind of movie. I would have liked to have seen it played more. They were trying to do a John Ford Western, when a Bud Bedeker Western might have worked a lot better for them. But there are some other good bits as well. The alien technologies and the aliens themselves are pretty cool, though. They tend to be characterless, even though there is a kind of main baddie alien with whom Daniel Craig's Lonergan has had encounters before. I don't think that it's a bit harder, because these things are very much alien creatures. They're not anywhere anthropomorphized. They've got heads like sea turtles, because John Favreau had gone on holiday to Hawaii and seen sea turtles and thought that having the aliens' heads would be cool like that. They're almost bulletproof for the most part. And they've got slimy arms that come out of the center of their bodies. But on the whole, they're quite a good creation. They move twice as fast as a human being. They're immensely strong. One of them can take down a man and his horse running at full speed. And so there's a real sense that these things are an enemy to be reckoned with. And that kind of works. I think that because they did all of it in kind of fast motion and kind of used the ILM special effects as a combination of CG and physical effects in this one. But I think that there might have been some benefit in giving us more of a view about what the aliens are doing. You don't have to necessarily show it to the characters. Show the from the viewpoint of the characters that these aliens are twice as fast as a human being and as strong as a horse. But for the audience, there needed to be a moment or two when we got a better view of them and a better idea of what they were and how they worked. And we don't necessarily get that in this film. We don't really get, not a humanization of the aliens, but a personalization of the aliens. We don't get a sense of them beyond what they can do. And a movie, even a movie like Predator, through the eyes of the mercenaries in, say, Predator, we get a strong sense of what the alien is and what it's doing, and we get enough of that. But you don't get that in this movie, and it doesn't work for that reason. The aliens are basically here mining gold off planet Earth, which, again, is one of those stupid things that people who don't know science fiction do in science fiction movies. They say that, oh, the alien's here to take our water, or the alien's here to take our gold, or the alien's here for this or that reason. And anybody who knows anything about astrophysics goes, well, why don't they just get the water from the rings of Saturn? Or why don't they just get the gold from some supernova remnants somewhere rather than dragging it in and out of a gravity well with an atmosphere and going through all that hassle? They don't kind of think it through because they're looking at things from an earthly point of view rather than a much broader point of view of aliens traveling from another star system. So that's one of my pet peeves in this kind of movie. The fact that they basically dumb it down and don't go, okay, well, if the aliens want this, why don't they get it from there? There's none of that. Mostly because Hollywood script writers aren't necessarily scientifically literate. But the alien spaceship's nice. It's a bit different than most alien spaceships we see. And we do get the kind of people gathering together, the townspeople, Lonergan, Colonel Dolehide, played by Harrison Ford, and I'll talk more about Harrison Ford in a moment, and the local Apaches, all of them kind of band together against this common menace. And without making it too much of a spoiler, they succeed. Harrison Ford doesn't really work in this. He plays grumpy and he plays a kind of hard-ass boss kind of person, but of course you've got to soften him by having him build a relationship with the kid that tags along for the battle against the aliens. But I really don't think it works. He's kind of, you know, got his own history, and he talks a little bit about that and about some of the things he experienced when he was the boy's age. But there's not really a connection to the character. It really doesn't work well. You need somebody like a Spencer Tracy to carry off that kind of stuff. Somebody with, and Harrison Ford's very good at certain kinds of things, but he's not the most gifted actor on this clay and granite planet. And I don't think it works really well for him to play that role. I think there may have been other actors who did. In fact, I was thinking about this when I watched an episode of Penny Dreadful last night. They brought in the English actor Brian Cox to play one of the characters' fathers in the movie, and he has to talk about some monstrously horrible things that happened to his family. And Brian Cox, sitting in a chair talking, is mesmerizing. He really has the cadences right. He has the emotion. He has the withholding of emotion right. The timing and everything like that. It would have been really good to see Brian Cox play that role, because Brian Cox is the kind of an actor who can carry off that emotional engagement in a way that Harrison Ford definitely can't. And Harrison Ford is definitely one of the weak places in this movie. I know a lot of people like him, but I don't think playing a tough and cruel rancher really makes it work. I think there's a little bit too much Spielberg in the upshot at the end of the movie for the character, and by saying that, it's the kind of sickening, sweet, happy ending Spielberg-y stuff that I really don't like. And the other thing, then, here's the core of it, here's the guts of it, here's the bit right at the center of things that simply doesn't work. The movie is very humorless. Now, one of the things we know from John Ford Westerns, from Bud Bedecker Westerns, from Sergio Leone Westerns, from every kind of Western that we know of, here's something that works, and here's something that's a necessary safety valve for action, sadism, adventure, and all that kind of thing. You need one character who is the comic relief. In Rio Bravo, you've got Stumpy, played by Walter Brennan. In Bud Bedecker Westerns, you've sometimes even got Randolph Scott being the comic relief to himself in some ways. You need that kind of little bit of humor as yeast in the bread of the movie. You need that thing that lifts it just a little bit and expands it a little bit. And humor forms that function in Westerns. You just need that as a part of a good Western. And essentially, this is a Western, whereas rather than, I mean, it's in the title, rather than cowboys and Indians, we have cowboys and aliens. So the movie is, at its heart, a Western. Whereas the other movie I'm going to talk about, Serenity, is at its heart something different, even though it does have the format of a Western. But that humor and that comic relief part is missing. Maybe it got missed or dropped or forgotten when it's been handed among a whole bunch of script writers in the past. But you need that kind of slight lightness there. It doesn't have to be heavy-handed. It doesn't have to be slapstick. It doesn't have to be overwritten and crazy. But you need that little bit of humor to make us less bored with constant action and constant angst and constant drama. It's a change of pace that gives us a chance as an audience to catch our breath. And that movie is lacking that. And it's really weird too, because Favreau knows how to do this stuff. Favreau's really good at it. In Iron Man and Iron Man 2, he did it really well. He did it exceptionally well in Chef. And so as a director, he definitely knows how to do that. Whether his hands were tied by the studio or whether the size of the project and the mixed history of it and the recasting, they were going to cast other people that started. Originally, it was going to star Robert Downey Jr., but he dropped out to do the second Sherlock Holmes film. Or it may have been the first one, I'm not sure. But one way, one of the Sherlock Holmes films. And they had some trouble casting Dolla Hyde and ended up with Harrison Ford. So there's all that. And one of the characters was supposed to be a large Mexican guy, but when Sam Rockwell expressed an interest, they recast and rewrote the role for Sam Rockwell. And it turned out to be not a particularly interesting or cool character. Even though, as we all know, Sam Rockwell is an exceptionally gifted actor, I don't think that the role gave him much to chew on and much to digest, playing the kind of town doctor come barkeeper who's trying to find his wife. Because the role came in so late and because it was rewritten so late, I don't think it integrates very well with the rest of the story. There are some other bits that kind of work nicely. Finding the riverboat, which I'm not going to spoil beyond saying they find a riverboat, was kind of cool, but I don't think it was given the visual punch that was necessary for that kind of thing. They see something extraordinary, an upside-down riverboat in the middle of the desert, which for some reason, which the aliens obviously are placed there. But it's kind of like they should have given it a lot more emphasis rather than making it, oh yeah, there's a riverboat upside down, the guys are going to mention it and then they're going to take shelter in it. You need a lot more punch there. You need the kind of punch that you got, say, in, and I don't particularly like this film, but it does have a few of these kind of punchy moments. In Close Encounters of the Third Kind, where they find a ship in the middle of the desert, it needs that kind of visual punch, but it singularly lacks that. And there are some things that had that potential to be cool in this movie, but they just weren't underlined in just the right way. You don't have to heavily underline some things, but you just need that kind of wow factor to make them really interesting in a film. And unfortunately, this film just doesn't do that with some of the potentially cool things in it. I mean, the reveal of the aliens should have been handled a lot more strongly, for instance. But I think Favreau is very much an actor's director, and so with the kind of CG-heavy side of it, I think that it didn't play to his strengths. And, of course, a lot of that stuff is determined by the people doing the effects and by the studios and by the effects budget. And so maybe Favreau didn't get his own way with some things. But I really think that you've got to have a wow factor about the unusual in this kind of a film. And we don't get that at all. We're kind of invested in the Daniel Craig character to a big extent. We're invested in the sheriff who soon goes away, which is unfortunate. We're invested in the preacher. And to a certain extent, we're invested in the kid who tags along. But as far as Dolarhyde, the rancher, and Olivia Wilde's character, we just don't have an investment in them because they're not written well enough or acted well enough for us to want to put ourselves forward and kind of emotionally attach ourselves for the duration of the film with those particular characters. So is Cowboys and Aliens a good film or a bad film? Well, I think it kind of sits in the middle there. I think it was one of those movies that has unfulfilled potential. It was based on a graphic novel, by the way, which I haven't read and which I will try to find and read at some stage. But I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I think graphic novels are just a different way of telling a story and a visual way of telling a story, which makes them seem at first to be easy adaptations for movies. But as people who have adapted them have often found out, there are nuances and subtleties to graphic novels which aren't immediately apparent. People tend to look down their noses at them a little bit, but translating them from the page to the screen, there are very easily bits that are missed. And also there are bits that need to be expanded for cinema that aren't necessarily on the page. So it's a little bit of both ways. You know, you can miss the subtleties, but there are interacting things and kind of linkages that you need to put in for cinema that aren't necessarily on the page. So one of the other reasons, of course, it doesn't work is that the ensemble doesn't particularly work, even though individual actors work very well in some of the roles. Daniel Craig's at his best in this movie when he's in pain, because he's one of those actors whose particular skill set leads itself to expressing anguish and determination very well, and that's perfect for the role. He is very well cast in this particular role, but other people less so. Anyway, I'm going to take another break, and when I get back, we're going to talk about a movie that works because of its previous history as a television series and works very well because of it and expands upon the universe created in the original Firefly television series. And that, of course, is 2005's Serenity, starring Nathan Fillion, Alan Tudyk, Miranda Baccarin, Gina Torres, Jewel State, and Sean Maher, and, of course, Summer Glau.
Hands and knees and heads bowed down. Everybody down.
This is a robbery, but what we're after is not yours. Listen up. We're coming down to empty that vault.
You have to give me your authorization password. Okay.
This is the captain. We may experience some slight turbulence and then explode.
I don't want to explode.
So here's us. On the raggedy edge.
Come a day, there won't be room for naughty men like us to slip about at all.
I'm taking your sister under my protection here.
She's conditioned for combat. She's a creature of extraordinary grace.
The only people she's a threat to is us on this boat.
River, do you want to stay with them?
It isn't safe for them.
Every minute you keep her from me, more people will die.
You think I care?
Of course you care.
The Alliance has gone to enormous trouble to find a little friend. You all know what it is you're carrying.
Somebody say, oh yeah!
Do you know that girl?
I really don't.
It's worse than you know.
It usually is.
So where's it writ that we gotta lay down our lives for her?
You wanna run this ship?
Yes.
Well, you can't.
No more running. I am to misbehave.
It's a fair bet that the Alliance knows what's coming.
No, they're not gonna see this coming.
Do you really think any of us are gonna get through this?
Well, I might.
This is going to get pretty interesting.
Define interesting.
Oh, God, we're all going to die?
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
The universe is gonna know the truth.
You're willing to die for that?
I am.
Serenity is a 2005 science fiction movie directed and written by Joss Whedon, based on his television series of a couple of years before, Firefly. It stars the usual cast of Firefly: Nathan Fillion as Mal Reynolds, Gina Torres as Zoe, Alan Tudyk as Wash, Miranda Baccarin as Inara, Adam Baldwin as Jane, Jewel State as Kaylee, Sean Mara as Simon, and Summer Glau as River Tan. Also, it has Ron Glass as Shepherd Book, and Chiwetel Ejiofor as the operative, the nominal bad guy of the movie. This one works for a number of reasons. Mostly, here's the easy part, and the movie standalone does set it up nicely. The characters feel lived in because they've been characters in a TV series. The actors knew their characters really well. Joss Whedon knew how to write for them really well, and it really works for that reason. Everybody is, you know, has a certain role in the ensemble. You got Mal as the war veteran, who was on the unsuccessful side of a war, kind of like a Confederate war veteran in many westerns. This is in some ways a western. You have Gina Torres as Zoe, who was his 2IC in their unsuccessful part of the war. She married the pilot Wash, played by Alan Tudyk, who acts in this as, in fact, everybody acts as comic relief in this movie, with the possible exception of Inara and the operative. Everybody gets to be the comic relief at various times in this movie, and that is kind of cool and slightly realistic, because in real life, everybody's comic relief some of the time. And this movie kind of recognises that. You've then got Adam Baldwin as Jane, the kind of, you know, should first ask questions later mercenary. Jewel State as the mechanic, Kaylee. And it's kind of nice to have the Scotty of the ship being a young female as well. This is part of what Whedon does, that kind of empowerment of female characters. The fact that Zoe's as tough as anybody on the ship. The fact that Kaylee's as competent with mechanical stuff as anybody on the ship. And then we have Inara, who is a kind of courtesan philosopher. A whore with a heart of gold is a trope in a lot of westerns, but this one takes it differently. This one, the whore with a heart of gold becomes something different, becomes almost not necessarily a Buddhist monk, but becomes a philosophical part of a not quite religious order, but of an order of companions who are for hire sexually, but also act as a psychological counselor in a weird kind of way. It's very complex, but it kind of really does work, and it destigmatizes sex workers as well. And being the feminist that he is, Whedon deliberately put that in as part of the plot. And I do like that, even though Inara isn't one of the main players in the plot, at least of Serenity rather than Firefly, her kind of tentative and slightly prickly relationship with Mal makes it work. And, the ensemble kind of really does work. You got then Sean Mars Simon, who's a doctor who's rescued his sister, River Tam, from the Alliance. But she's a psychic. She's a not an idiot savant, but a savant in a number of ways. Incredibly physically adept at martial arts. She's a precog. She's slightly telepathic. She's been psychologically tortured by the Alliance, and they, of course, are fleeing from the Alliance. And that's part of the tension in the movie as well. The plot's fairly simple. Because River Tam has been telepathic, been in the presence of some very powerful people in the Alliance send the operative out to kill and or capture her. Now, the operative is played by Chiwetel Ejiofor, who I love as an actor. He's a fantastic actor. He can do anything, acting is concerned. If they ever want a black Doctor Who, Chewie would be the guy to go to play a black Doctor Who, amongst other people. There are any number of good black actors who could play it. But, his operative is scary in a lot of ways. He's kind of softly spoken. He seems sympathetic, but he's a true believer. He believes that the Alliance is saving human civilization, and he will act in any way he needs to follow through with that agenda. And some of the best writing in Serenity is for the operative, where we kind of learn who he is and who he isn't, and how he psychologically manipulates people, how he's an assassin who pretends to be compassionate even when he's not, and particularly in the bits with Michael Hitchcock in the start of the movie. And he's physically incredibly gifted martial artist. He's a tactical genius. He's everything you don't want chasing you when you're running away from things. And because he's played by an actor with the gravitas and charisma of Chiwetel Ejiofor, it really does work. He's one of the creepiest villains in science fiction in the 21st century because, A, he's very plausible. B, he's soft-spoken, but the agenda and the philosophy behind him is incredibly repugnant. And C, because he shows us the perils of fanaticism. And that really does work nicely in this context. And that's something I've noticed. Whedon's tapped into something there with the operative, and I'll talk about the other characters more a little bit later. The operative, I was watching Q&A, which is a TV show here in Australia, where a panel of experts are asked questions by members of the audience, both online and in the audience. I also am a part of their Twitter stream, and I get my tweets up on screen sometimes, acting as a kind of Greek chorus to what's going on the television. So that's a bit of fun for me. But on Q&A, they had a guy called Lyle Shilton, who is the head of the Australian Christian Lobby. And he's got that thing down pat. He does that kind of plausible, nicely spoken, seemingly reasonable, but utterly, utterly repugnant worldview approach. That's one of the things with media, and one of the dangers of media, is that fanatics can portray themselves as nice people in the media. And even though they can couch what they're saying in oblique terms, they're talking to a specific audience and dog whistling to a specific audience and following through on a very nasty and exclusive as opposed to inclusive agenda. And the operative is very much like that. He's dangerous because he sounds reasonable, not to mention the fact that he carries a sword and is willing to kill anybody that gets in his way. That reasonableness is one of his tactics to lull people into a false sense of comfort and security before he attacks. And that makes him a really interesting character as well. Now, the whole universe of Firefly / Serenity is very interesting. The human race has migrated from the depleted Earth into a solar system of multiple suns and lots of planets and tons of moons, most of which, apart from the suns, they've terraformed and settled. So basically there are a whole bunch of different cultures on a whole bunch of different small and large worlds. They've also seemed to have some way of making the gravity on all the planets 1G, but we can kind of hand wave that and saying, well, they've controlled gravity and they're very, very good at terraforming. So we'll accept the world, the verse, as they call it, short for universe, as a very complex place with a whole bunch of different environments, a whole bunch of different cultures that have been there for hundreds of years. They developed mostly from European and Chinese culture, so there are Chinese influences there in the verse, and the Alliance is at the core of things with the kind of frontier planets towards the rim, and beyond the rim there are some humans called Reavers who basically are psychotically insane. If you haven't seen Serenity, remembering Ghosts of Mars, they had the people that were going insane and attacking all of the Martian settlements and things like that. They're a kind of combination between them and the worst aspects of the villains in a Mad Max movie. The Reavers will, they're cannibals, they're murderers, they're rapists, they are everything dark in human nature. And what Serenity does is tells us how they came about. The crew of Serenity find that there's a planet nobody knows about called Miranda, which is beyond the circumference of the verse in the territory which is held by the Reavers, and to find out what's happening there, and also to escape the operative. The crew of Serenity have to go through the Reaver territory to Miranda and find out what the secret is, and that's the main crux of the plot. And it kind of works. It's a straight-through-line plot. It's simple. It's clean. We know what everybody's motivation is because we know the characters well. And also, even if we don't, one of the things that Whedon does very well is gives us a quick kind of update on the characters. We know who they are, what their relationship to all of the other characters, the main characters are, and what their ultimate motives are. I mean, with Simon, it's love of his sister. We don't know River Tam enough because she's such a broken person. We know that she cares for the other people aboard the ship, but that her damage causes her to be a threat to them as well. We know Mal is basically, you know, wants to live his life on his own terms, but with his own people, if he can, but ultimately he's got to make money. Zoe and Wash are backing him up on that. Jane just wants to make money. We do meet Shepherd Book, but he's never aboard Serenity, and we know he's a kind of confidant, father figure to Mel in a lot of ways, and it's a shame we don't get more of him because Ron Glass is very good as Shepherd Book. Kaylee is attracted to Simon, and Simon's attracted to Kaylee, and she's basically trying to keep the ship from falling out of the sky. And Inara is incredibly fond of them all, and is walking her own path as a companion. So we have a clear sense of who everybody is, what their motives are. The universe is beautifully textured as well, even though the movie was made on a $40 million budget, which isn't a hell of a lot these days. You do get a great sense of, or even in those days, which was 11 years ago now this movie was made, you do to get a sense of an incredibly complex universe, an incredibly dangerous one, but a very interesting one. We meet some other characters in there, Mr. Universe, who basically is acting there almost as a WikiLeaks come anonymous, you know, trying to get the truth of what's happening out in the universe by having an incredibly powerful transmitter and transmitting everything he finds out to it. He lives on a space station by himself with a robot sex companion, which is kind of cool, and people kind of accept that he's one of those people who goes for a marriage ceremony with a robot, and it's just kind of accepted as part of his eccentricity. We also meet a couple of people who deal in dodgy merchandise, Fante and Mingo, played by Jan Feldman and Raphael Feldman, who are twins. The name's Fante and Mingo is another nod to something else, and some people will get it, some people won't. But for those who don't, Fante and Mingo were the gay gangsters in a 1955 crime movie called The Big Combo, which had Richard Conte and Cornel Wilde in it. So it's a bit of a nod to that. It's a famous film noir, known best to film noir movie buffs who know these things and know that Fante and Mingo is a cool name for a couple of guys in something like this. We also have a brief scene with Sarah Paulson as Dr. Karen. We see her in hologram form, which is kind of cool, and she brings to us some of the horror of what's happening and happened on the planet Miranda, and how the Alliance is responsible for an enormous atrocity. In fact, a genocidal atrocity on that planet. And this just works well as a space opera. It works well as a Western. It works well as good, honest action storytelling, which doesn't have a sexist bone in its body. It's fair to everybody. It shows us the dynamic in this film is interesting because you can look at it one way and saying that the crew of the Serenity are freedom-loving libertarians who just want to be left alone and don't want to be controlled by Big Brother and don't want to be controlled by big government and all that kind of thing. That's one side of it. But the other side of it is the conservative versus liberal, in the small L sense, dynamic as well. The Alliance represents everything that's wrong with conservative politics, whereas the crew of Serenity being kind of inclusive and multicultural and, well, not fantastically multicultural, but somewhat multicultural, but accepting of human frailty and being outlaws and wanting to live life on their own terms and yet taking in waifs and strays and building a family with them is very much at the other side of politics. So there are a number of different political aspects to Serenity, which are kind of interesting to behold. There is the other aspect of it, which is the people who want to control information, the people who want information to be free. That's very much a big theme in this. And the dynamic between the fanaticism of the operative and the almost family-oriented wish for freedom that the crew represents. From the action point of view, there's some interesting things going on as well. A couple of the actors didn't want to commit long-term in case Serenity became a series of movies, which unfortunately it didn't. And so a couple of the main characters die during the film. And this works really well for the dynamic of the storytelling because there is a kind of Alamo last stand towards the end, which is made more powerful and made more cogent by the fact that a couple of characters have already died, and anybody can die in this movie. It's one of those things where they've done the slow escalation and you know, characters we like die in this film. And so when things get rough and the Reavers are attacking the crew on Miranda and they're kind of running from one place to the other and trying to hold off the Reavers while Mel gets the information about what's happened to Miranda out to the universe, there's a real sense of urgency about what happens there. And when I first saw the movie, I saw it in the cinema with Sal. When I first saw the movie, that urgency was really an important part of it too. You know, you didn't know who was going to survive. You didn't know who was going to prevail and that you know, how things would move on from there. But there is that kind of kick-ass ending, which is really, really cool. And there's a lot of blood and guts and gore and action and everything else you want in a good, honest adventure film. I'm sure over the long term, Serenity has made more than its money back. It's on Netflix constantly. It's sold quite well on Blu-ray and DVD here in Australia. And it is kind of comfort viewing in a lot of ways. It's, yeah, we like the TV series. The TV series is selling well on disc and people are watching it in streaming services as well. I only ended up doing half a season and they were shown out of order in America, which majorly sucked. But that's the nature of television, really. There are series that really deserved to do better than they did. But ultimately, for some reasons political, some reasons economic, some reasons just unfortunate accidents of timing, they don't get the oxygen they need to burn well. And that's what happened here. And having that Serenity movie gives us a capstone for the whole thing and lets us kind of move on from being invested with these characters. It really does work well as a way of giving a decent ending to something that ended prematurely. Whereas there are other things that don't do so well. I mean, X-Files did something either 8 or 11 seasons. And then they did two quite bad X-Files movies. And now they've done the X-Files miniseries, which hardly anybody loved. And you get the sense of it cashing in. It's a cash cow kind of approach to a franchise, which if money is your only primary motivation, things aren't going to be as passionately done as if you have a lot of other strong reasons to do something as well. And I think that very much Serenity is about that passion. The groundswell of fandom after the Firefly TV series ended was significant, and the actors are very well regarded and their careers have moved on in different directions. Some have kind of gone higher, some have stayed where they are, some of them have moved on to other parts of their life, but all of them seem to be proud of what they did. Of course, the other problem with the series, and this is what I call the I Spy problem, is that Adam Baldwin being a part of the Gamergate and doxing people and being quite an unfortunately nasty human being in social media has kind of made things less comfortable when you see that, when you see Adam Baldwin in Serenity. And if you know what he does in the real world and in social media, it is makes the movie a less joyous experience. And the reason I call it the I Spy thing is I Spy, the TV series, had Robert Culp and Bill Cosby in it. And Robert Culp, really nice guy from everything I know, really erudite about movies. And then Bill Cosby being who we now know Bill Cosby to be, watching episodes of I Spy is problematic for me now, even though I very much like the TV series. So more accurately, perhaps we can call it the Cosby effect. The fact that somebody's actions in the real world has a negative effect on how we view the fiction they were a part of. And this is a kind of function of social media to a certain extent. But it is something I wrestle with at times and something I wonder about at times and something I go, okay, how do we deal with media that we love that includes works by people we now find morally repugnant? I mean, there's a bit in the good Australian Aboriginal musical Brand New Day, there's a little bit where people sing a Rolf Harris song. And that's the one bit that takes us out of the movie and puts us in a different headspace. Rolf Harris, having been, is currently jailed for a number of offences in England. But people didn't know that when Brand New Day came out. And so the musical Brand New Day, which if you can find a copy of, I recommend highly, has that one bit of Rolf Harris in it, which kind of takes us out of the movie and takes us to a darker place in our minds than perhaps we should. But just to finalise on Serenity, I think it's a good honest space opera. I think it's a lot of fun. I think it's a good template for how things can be done well. And it shows that you can have the darkest of dark themes in a movie, along with humour and love and compassion and charismatic characters and just that usual fan squee. You can balance them all out, but it has to be done very, very well. And the casting has to be very good. And that's the thing to take away from this episode of Martian Driving Podcast. Things don't work unless the casting is there and unless you have a sense of humour about what you're doing. So that's about it this time around. I'm now going to re-record the Patreon credits. And thank you again to the Patreon subscribers who are all marvellous people and whom I wish every happiness in life, as I indeed do the rest of you. You guys are spending your time listening to me rabbit on about shit, and you like it, so I'm kind of inclined then to wish you all the best in the world. But anyway, that's about it this time around. As I said, the next Martian Drive-In podcast is going to be filmed before a live audience at Continuum 12, along with Narelle Harris and Grant Watson, so I'm looking forward to that. I will be doing audience giveaways at the convention. Adult language will be used and silliness will ensue. But anyway, in the meantime, look after yourselves. Take care. Keep out of the sun if you're in the north. Keep out of the cold wind if you're down in the south. And I'll be back in 2 weeks. Bye. Thank you to all of the Patreon subscribers. And here are the credits in the style of movie credits to acknowledge and thank all of them. We have Tom, our focus puller. Sarah, our special effects technician. Ian, our caterer. Grant, our Technicolor consultant. Claire, our script doctor. Gary, our prop master. Morris, our music director. Jan, our dialect coach. Armin, our key grip. Matt, our rattlesnake wrangler. Elaine, our scientific advisor. Julia, our casting director. Chris, our camera operator. Christopher, our gaffer. Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress. Tansy, the foley artist. Alyssa, the location scout. Mark, our second unit director. Paul, our special makeup effects director. Tammy, our donut wrangler. Tim, our New York unit director. Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor. Steve, our script doctor. Dylan, our goat wrangler. Eric, our set security lead. Kerry, our second script doctor. Richard, our set photographer. And our extras, Kathleen, Mark and David. So thank you very much to all the subscribers, and you too can subscribe at patreon.com/paleocinema.